House Committee on Revenue for March 6, 2017 will come to order. Colleagues, we have three related bills to hear today, so we're going to open a public hearing on all three, and therefore we open a public hearing on House Bill 2115, House Bill 2047, and House Bill 2052. Kyle?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'll start with House Bill 2052, just because it's the easiest one to describe, but it's a bill that would require the Legislative Revenue Office to conduct a study of the exemption from ad valorem property taxation of the property of nonprofit corporations. It does have a nice relating to clause as well.
Thank you. So, colleagues, you may note a pattern here.
And then I guess I can start with House Bill 2115.
Please.
And I actually have a document up in the meeting materials in OLS under House Bill 2115. That's a little bit easier, I think, to follow along than the actual SMS. There's a few changes, but it sets it up, I think, will be easier to see. But the general idea of House Bill 2115 is it's the intent, or it's attempting, it looks like, to remove from the ORS 307-130 exemption, which is the exemption available to literary, charitable, and scientific organizations, removing from that exemption qualification, and there's probably some change that would be required to actually effectively do that, had a discussion with Ledge Council. But in its place, it would create a new exemption, and that's in Section 1, and there would be two ways for properties to qualify for this exemption. And it's related to, this is going to be property of healthcare organizations, hospitals and healthcare organizations are the ones that are going to be affected. And the qualification option two would be if you're a type A hospital property or a rural critical access hospital property, then you're going to be exempt from property taxation. The qualification option one is then for all those that are not in the type A or rural critical access hospital. And it'd be for property that's used or to provide health services or administrative services that support those health services. And the secondary requirement, this is I'm in the box, qualification option one, is the property or the property owner would have to get a certificate from the Oregon Health Authority. And to get that certificate, the hospital or health system would have to have total expenditures from for community benefits in an amount equal to or greater than 5% of gross receipts of the hospital or health system. Or there's an option for if the hospital or health system can show good cause for why they're below that 5%, they could still get that certificate. But there'd be some rules OHA would have for that. And so that's the two ways to qualify. A note is there would be a requirement to annually apply to the county assessor. However, that would be for a property that's owned by these health services or organizations, or the health organizations. However, if it's being leased, there is no annual requirement to apply to the assessor, just be the one time only. And then I have in the other changes in the measure, I can go through in bullet point, or I can just hit the high points.
Why don't you hit the high points for now, and we'll see if other things come up in the questioning, because I'd like to get these two in and out.
Okay, quickly. Yes, Mr. Chair. So just the high points of other changes is it makes changes to community benefit statute, the definition of it, what would be included there. So there's changes related to that. The other one is there's a number of non-conforming statutory changes to 307-130, so there's a lot of text in there, but a lot of those are LC changes. And then a couple important pieces is the timing of it. So there's a little the timing for the property tax-related pieces of the measure begins with the 2017-18 property tax year. However, the requirements and the items relating to the certificate become operative January 1st, 2018. So there's a little bit of a timing difference there right now that could make it difficult, I guess, to implement the introduced version. So just to make note of that.
You'd have to change one or the other of those dates, I think is what you just said.
Yes, and the property tax one, that's beginning with the property tax year we're under right now. So there would have to be some properties wouldn't be able to put in the application because it doesn't exist yet.
Right.
So,
okay.
For what that is worth.
Welcome. It's not often we get health committee chairs in this committee. We're very glad to see you today.
That's right. We're happy to be here today. Thank you for inviting us. I'm State Representative Mitch Greenock, House District 33, and I'm delighted to be here to talk about the whole question of hospital community benefit. This, by the way, is a work in progress. We're working very closely with the Hospital Association, the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems, to come up with a bill that they can support and I think we're very close, so we'll have some amendments here. The basic principle is that community benefits of nonprofit hospitals should be a part of the basic work they do. It shouldn't be something they have a little money left over, they provide some charity care, they provide some other kinds of community benefit services. This bill really tries to build into the work of the hospital community benefit, which can include education, research, and charitable care. This has been pushed on us now because we managed to enroll 95% of Oregon's population in health insurance through Medicaid or the exchange or other methods. The charitable care contribution to hospitals has dropped dramatically, and it's not been converted, at least up till now, into other community benefit activities. This bill says two major functions. In the current definition of community benefit, as a result of a bill we passed, I think, 6 years ago, it allows hospitals to charge underpayment for Medicare and Medicaid as a community benefit. The hospital in my district, when I looked at their community benefit report, reported that they spent 8% of their profit, 8% of their revenue on community benefit. 6 of those 8% were spent on claimed underpayment for Medicare and Medicaid. This bill would take that out of the definition in its current form of those things as community benefit. And it would add a minimum standard of 5%. Incidentally, the bill talks about gross patient revenue on page 2. It's really net patient revenue we're talking about. We're really talking about not the amount of money that hospitals bill, because everybody knows those bills are mythical charges, but the amount of revenue they actually receive as operating revenue. This would require them to spend 5% of community benefit on education, research, and charitable care in order to maintain their tax-exempt status. The tax-exempt status talks about here as property tax exemption, but if they lost their tax-exempt, state tax-exempt status, they could easily be assessed for a minimum income tax, business activities tax, or other things. So this is very important to hospitals, and you'll be hearing from them as they comment on it. But it's my hope that we'll actually produce a bill before we're done that will at least, if not have the support of the Hospital Association, at least have their tacit approval of it. There are a lot of details, but that's the basic principle. I hope you'll be hearing a lot of testimony today. That testimony should be useful in guiding amendments. I'll be bringing you amendments as we work those things out. And thank you for having us. Great bill, should pass, but it needs a little work.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair, and members of the committee. I'm Lori Monis Anderson, the senator from Gresham, Trout, Deadwood Village, and Fairview. I'm delighted to be here, and I just want to remind everyone that when we went through the healthcare transformation, accountability and transparency is an extremely important issue that we have to have, and especially since there's so many tax dollars in the healthcare system. The hospital industry now today is a multi-billion dollar industry, and it is functioning as a traditional corporation, and they do have healthy profit margins and average annual profits of nearly $17 million per nonprofit hospital in Oregon in 2015. And we do have no really clear guidelines about what healthcare property is taxable and what is not. And many hospitals are claiming property tax exemptions for facilities that are providing unknown levels of charity care, if anything. So in House Bill 2115, it is responding to the changing ownership structures of health clinics and clarifies the charitable obligation that individual clinic properties must meet in order to claim a property tax exemption. And this would create a clear line for assessors to follow and prevent resources from being wasted in legal battles. And then House Bill 2047, the community benefit and charity care, there's a growing need for increased accountability around taxpayers' investments in the nonprofit hospitals. And House Bill 2047 would end the practice of including unreimbursed Medicaid and Medicare, although we're now working to just have maybe Medicare or program costs in the community benefit. I think we're talking about keeping Medicaid as part of that, if I recall what the discussions are about. But that's all I have to say. Again, it's a work in progress, and I would urge you to consider this, these bills very seriously. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions? Now's your chance, Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for your work on this most important bill. I think, Representative Greenlick, you mentioned education as being one of the parts of community benefit, but I don't see it here. Is it supposed to be on this list?
Yeah, community benefits should include education, such as medical education and other patient education programs, as well as research and charitable care. Right. It should definitely be included.
Right. Follow up.
Please.
Yeah, it's not there, at least not on the one I'm looking at. The other question is one that's much more basic, and I participated in the group that met over the summer trying to sort this out, and I found it to be extremely complicated. So I'll ask this one simple question, and that is that if we have chosen to place a exemption on a certain type of activity, I know a university, and we don't go into the university to check how much profit it's making. We simply make sure that it's engaged in those kinds of activities, and there are certain requirements under 501c3 designation, no self-enurement and things of that nature. But here, where people are engaged in healthcare, we say, oh, we're going to look because you're having a lot of money left over even though you're not a profit. And so we are going to go ahead under this approach, and because you're making money, even though you are a hospital, you're under this nice little umbrella of hospital. All these activities are things we really do want, but we're going to go ahead and look at, I guess, the profit is what's driving this. And then, using that as the fulcrum for our actions in this bill, we decide we're going to call out certain things that these activities must engage in. And I just wonder if this is a complicated piece of work, and you go, wow, is this the way to achieve the outcome desired? I can think of other ways, perhaps being more cautious in how we pay for the services rendered by a hospital so they don't end up with $17 million in profit. But we come circle around the other way and tax them, or suggested that we do if they don't do exactly the right thing with the money. I just wonder where this leads. It's a long, long diatribe, but do what you can with it.
Mr. Yes. Chair, Representative Menz, I love simple questions.
Yes.
This is a historical issue. I first came across this bill, I mean this concept of community benefit and what a nonprofit status means, when I ran the community benefit program for Kaiser Permanente for about 20 years in the 70s and 80s. The issue really came out of what an IRS definition of nonprofit status is. And I remember some discussions with the lawyers saying, well, how much do we need to spend on community benefit in order to maintain our nonprofit status? And they said, well, the IRS never made it very clear as to what it is. But from case law, we know any time a hospital spent more than 5% of their net revenue on community services, their nonprofit status was upheld. And sometimes when it was below 5%, sometimes it was upheld and sometimes it wasn't. So why don't we do 5% as a routine, and that looks like that'll be safe. The IRS did demand this kind of a test in order to maintain the federal nonprofit status, and we're carrying that over. The difference here is I don't believe it's about the profit of hospitals. And in fact, my argument, and I think you'll hear the Hospital Association agreement with this argument, that these kind of community services benefits should be a part of the actual work plan of a hospital. It shouldn't be something left over. The hospital, as an eleemosynary institution, provides care in the community, provides charity care, and does other important health-related activities that are a part of its activity as a nonprofit institution. So you didn't hear me talking about excess hospital profits. I think this should be a part of a business plan of a hospital, regardless of what their net profit is. That I don't think is the issue. I think it's a part of, you want to be an Elia-Mosinary institution, you should be proving you're an Elia-Mosinary institution by what you do. You shall be known by your works.
Follow up.
Please, yeah. Mm-hmm.
But how's that for an answer to a simple question?
Well, I think it's as general as was my question, so.
No. Things that are obvious to me aren't necessarily obvious to everybody else. I've learned to live with that, Representative Ben.
My follow-up would be, should we be looking at universities and saying, if they're not doing certain things, we should impose upon them these same kind of obligations? Should we go into that which they're doing and call out these things to say, hey, we don't think Willamette University, you're quite reaching the level that we want, and therefore we're going to impose upon you these specifics? And again, this is to go back to the original concept, which is to say, in a small town where I'm from, a hospital is a pretty darn important thing. And I know this bill appears to leave those small hospitals out, but stick with me. The idea is that all activities inside that building are really valuable. You really do want to have a hospital in your town. You really do. And therefore, we're not going to charge you taxes because the activities within that box are so incredibly important. And then we didn't look any further. As long as you were in there with a doctor and nurse and everybody else is supposed to take care of folks. But now what we're saying is that's not enough. We know you're engaged in these kinds of activities, but we're going to make sure that you're doing a number of them free, or the community benefit word, whatever that is. And so I just wonder at how we moved away from just looking at the activity inside the box over to specific things that had to be community benefit. I'm not saying it's wrong. I just find it interesting.
Well, I think you're, Mr. Chair, Representative Benz, I think you as a committee are asking about the nonprofit status of other kinds of institutions as well. I think asking what community service does an institution provide as a part of being a nonprofit institution is a perfectly valid question. And I think it's valid of universities, it's valid of churches, for that matter. There's been a longstanding relationship between measuring the related business activity of nonprofit institutions. The bowling alley owned by a university, for example, has been clearly defined as not a part of the nonprofit status. The Journal of the American Medical Association, as an activity of the AMA, has been defined a business rather than a nonprofit. And related business activities, taxes are charged to nonprofit institutions. So I think you're right. I think we should be looking at the definition of all nonprofit institutions, and I think you have a group working on that issue.
We do. Thank you.
And I think it is important because we're talking about the health of our community, and hospitals play a vital role on that. In that, and the activities that they, the benefits that they give to the community may at this point in time need to be looked at and defined to get the best bang for the dollar. And I know it's very, very complicated, but I hope that this the hospitals have always been at the table. I think they're going to continue to be at the table to see what, so that we will have a good bill. But we do have to look at defining what is a community benefit or not, and making sure that our tax dollars are being used in the right way, my perspective.
Thank you for the answer. What I'm trying to get at is that much of what goes on in the hospital that's not on this list of community benefits is of huge value when it comes to taking care of our health care needs. Huge. In fact, that's why we left hospitals out of the property tax focus for all these years. So what I'm saying is, I'm not quite sure it's the activity you're focusing on so much as it is the fact that there's a profit, and that this is a way, I'm not sure what, an excuse to try to direct more of that which this mm-hmm. building does toward that which doesn't make money, or perhaps we're forcing them to spend that money in a certain way. And that's my point.
But we do have clinics that are not nonprofit, and yet they are doing community benefit too. And so it, at least from some providers in my district, it isn't a level playing field. And whereas we're now having a lot of clinics associated with the hospitals cropping up all throughout our districts, and they're still able to claim a nonprofit and therefore not pay property taxes, where other clinics that are providing the same service are paying property taxes. So that's one way of looking at it, too.
Yeah, I would note that in House District 12, Senate District 6, there are two hospitals. One is a for-profit business owned by a company out of, I think, Tennessee.
Yep.
The other is a very well-known regional nonprofit hospital that's been that way for well over 100 years. So, and as you point out, they do provide very, very similar services, with the possible exception of this 5% piece that you're talking about. Representative Bueller, please.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Barnhart. I just want to draw attention to two issues here. One is, and I appreciate your work on this, I think we need to look at the community benefit concept and definition and how it's aligned with other goals, so I don't differ any there. But I just want to draw attention to a really important change in the definition of charity, of community, what is included in community benefit. That makes it much different than what the IRS has used as their typical definition. The 5% seems to be a standard practice in analyzing community benefit from the federal perspective, but they also include the losses related to Medicaid, Medicare, CHIP, and other publicly funded programs, and that's out of your definition. And that's a fundamental change, since it's such a large percentage of the traditional community benefit spending by Oregon hospitals. So, care to comment about that?
Yeah, well, this is going to change. It turns out the federal regulations are now eliminating the use of Medicare underpayment. We heard testimony on that last week. The hospitals really want us to put back in the ability to deduct the underpayment for Medicaid. In return for that, we would suggest raising that 5% to 7% or something and putting that back in. That's a part of the negotiation right now, but they've agreed to give up Medicare because I think it's a part of the federal regulations that aren't allowing that anymore.
And then I continue to have concerns about whatever this amount is of accountability with regards to how these community benefits are spent and how they align with our healthcare transformation, specifically spending on the social determinants of health. Is there anything in your bill that would help that problem?
There, Mr. Chair, Representative Bueller, there's a proposed amendment from the Northwest Health Foundation, among the amendments being considered, that would put some language in about the community benefit expenditures being related to the social determinants of health. That's one of the things that we're considering right now.
Thank you. Representative Nose.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to call attention to a thing I had put on OLIS that I think illustrates some of the dynamic around this. And it's a spreadsheet put together by the Oregon Health Authority, some policy person within them, that lists out all the hospitals in the state. And they've been doing this for a long time, and you can look at their profit and loss. And in addition to their profit and loss, it tracks really nicely what's going on with charity care. And I hope it's not lost on folks, it's probably already been mentioned, you know, part of the reason that the charity care expenditure is down and continues to go down is because reimbursement for people are insured now under the ACA, and care that would have gone just outright uncompensated for, that's not the case anymore. And so I think that's partially why we're having it. You know, these were hospitals, were institutions, you know, when they first got going, where it's a little macabre, but people went to die, basically. And over time, they have morphed into places where people go and they receive care, and they're less and less a place of last resort, and more, you know, now in this day and age, a modern healthcare facility where people get better. And yes, they're nonprofits. You know, I would argue the point that Representative Vence was making about nonprofit universities, there's some of that there too. You know, when football coaches and university presidents draw down very, very large salaries, I think it's worth looking at under the, you know, for what it's worth.
Was there a question embedded in that? Or
nope. I just wanted to see the Excels. There's a. I think that Excel spreadsheet illustrates really well what's been going on since the ACA came into play and why this charity care discussion and community benefits are important.
I've asked Kyle to reformat that so we can actually read all the columns together.
It reveals a lot.
Yeah, thank you. Unless there are other questions, we'll excuse these two. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much
for coming
Chair.
Today and presenting this interesting and important set of legislation. And Representative Greenlick, we're going to hold you to it get this figured out. I will note we have 13 people who want to testify, and we have just a bit more than an hour to do it. So I would ask you to keep your testimony as brief as possible while still making your points. And if someone else has already said it in great detail, perhaps you could simply say, yep, we agree on that one. Let's start with Michael Huntington, Bruce Thompson, and Linda Roman, please. If you'll state your name for the record and then give your testimony, that would be very helpful.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, I'm Michael Huntington, a retired physician from Corvallis, Oregon, and I represent Healthcare for All Oregon and Mid Valley Healthcare Advocates. I am testifying in favor of HB 2115. You may have records in front of you that say that the Hilltop Institute points out that Oregon is one of only 15 states that does not have explicit requirements for hospitals to report community benefit. We think HB 2115 will help the legislature and the public ensure that the money is used wisely. Many Oregon hospitals, including our hospital, Good Samaritan Regional Medical Center in Corvallis, do have community benefit programs. And so I think it's not so much that hospitals aren't doing this already. It's just that there are not standards. And since they are managing taxpayer money as a fiduciary agent for federal and state governments, hospitals are rightly directed by this bill to follow strict standards in the allotment and the use of that money. So we have offered, in addition to this, proposals that you may have in front of you now to further define how the use of community benefit might best be planned and how the public can most easily observe and influence the planning. So that's one step beyond the requirements of the bill. I can confirm for you that although our hospital does have an extensive community benefit program, it's very, very difficult to see into how they make their decisions. And this is an opaque process. We endorse the requirements listed in the bill that there be a defined percentage, which Representative Greenlick mentioned would be a net revenue rather than gross receipts. We think this legislation will make it easier to find out how much of our tax money is available in community benefit funds and how hospitals prioritize and allocate money for public health, including the kind of emergencies that Dr. Thompson will mention shortly. We think the passage of 2115 and our additional proposals will help our communities and the state budget. Thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today. I would be happy to answer questions.
Thank you very much. Please go ahead, and we'll ask questions of the panel.
Chair Barnhart, Vice Chair Bentz, and Smith Warner, my name is Lynette Roman. I'm the Policy Director for the Oregon Health Equity Alliance. Since 2009, OHEA, or Oregon Health Equity Alliance, has been representing the interests of communities of color, immigrant, and refugees whose population has grown over 750,000 in Oregon. OHEA is a 40-member organization that includes the Asian Pacific Network of Oregon, the Urban League of Portland, Oregon Latino Health Coalition, CAUSA, and the Native American Youth and Family Center. So together we work on addressing historic and persistent health disparities in working families and children. So we're all here in support of this because OHEA has been consistently engaged in state-level policy because of two intersected beliefs. First is that we all pay the price for poor health. Poor health undermines our economy and financial and emotional toll on families and small businesses when Oregonians do not have the care that they need. Secondly, we believe that access to care is the cornerstone of well-being for working families. Community benefit and Oregon hospitals have played a critical role in caring for our communities and closing health disparities. And we believe that when investments are tied to closing disparities and community-driven solutions, our systems and communities work better. They work better to improve the health of not only patients, but the health in the communities that they reside in. This is why we support the metrics that connects community benefit to social determinants of health and investing for the uninsured. And although Oregon has made substantial investments to ensure coverage to 95% of Oregonians, many Oregonians are still underinsured because their incomes fluctuate, or they can't afford copays and high deductibles, or they are uninsured because they're ineligible for health insurance. This is an immense amount. There's an immense amount of need to continue to invest in care. And many times, community-based approaches and investments are the bridge to ensure that people can get the care that they need to be healthy. So we support taking a step further to ensure that we're able to target historic and persistent disparities that go beyond care and invest in care that many still cannot have access to. So thank you.
Thank you very much. Yes, sir.
Chair Barnhart and members of the committee, I'm Dr. Bruce Thompson. I'm a retired family doc in private practice in Corvallis. I've been retired a couple of years, and in those couple of years, I've tried to do what I can to advance health care access to everyone in the state of Oregon. I also represent Mid Valley Healthcare Advocates, which is a longtime player in health care initiatives to advance health care to all Oregonians. I speak in here in favor of House Bill 2115. The community benefits derived from the money not paid in federal and state taxes by tax-exempt hospitals is the issue. House Bill 2115 would create legal guidelines for hospitals, and as Dr. Huntington has mentioned, Oregon is one of only 15 states in the nation that do not have those guidelines. In addition, H. Bill 2115 will allow the public to better observe how these public tax dollars are being spent, and even perhaps to influence how they are being spent. I'd like to give a couple examples regarding health inequities previously mentioned, but as well community benefit, and I think it partially addresses questions that Representative Bueller made regarding social determinants, also that Representative Greenlich brought up about social determinants and community benefit. So 2 years ago in Corvallis, there were 4 cases of tuberculosis. One of the cases died. 3 of the cases got admitted to the hospital. Our local health department was charged with the responsibility of tracking down other community members within our community to keep them out of the hospital and to save money. That was an immense expenditure of staff time by the health department, which limited what the health department could do regarding their normal foundational activities. So this is one example of how community benefit is advanced by what an underfunded agency does. And clearly, if the state collects more tax money to distribute to other not well-funded charges around the state, it would be better for the community at large. Presently, we have a outbreak of meningitis at the OSU campus, and once again, the community would benefit from some monies being spent on how to deal with this, because the health department doesn't have enough money to deal with it and take care of their other charges. So we're just this week we will be having a mass vaccination program, giving vaccinations to high risk students who may or may not have health care insurance. Again, a public benefit to everyone. If we can decrease the burden of disease within the community, that's a good thing. Similarly, U of O had an outbreak 2 years ago of meningitis, you're all aware of, huge expenses, but again, it comes out of one budget where it could be coming out of a community benefit set aside. So the point is that public tax dollars saved by nonprofit hospitals should be commensurate with the community benefit attained. House Bill 2115 addresses guidelines as to what qualifies for community benefit and how community benefit is determined. It also, House Bill 2115 also addresses guidelines that create transparency in fiscal accounting of community benefit. In addition, we've submitted some recommendations both to Representative Greenlick and to our testimony today, which we think actually might strengthen House Bill 2115. We're submitting them today, hoping that these might be helpful in the discussions yet to come, as Representative Greenlick indicated. Thank you for this opportunity to testify before you today, and we'll be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. Questions for this panel? Thank you. We very much appreciate your testimony today. I look like I have six who all signed up together, so I'm going to call some names and see if this is the order you want them in. Keith Hurley, George Brown, Jen Wielander. No objection, so I guess we'll go with this group first.
Good afternoon. I'm Keith Hurl. I have a small consulting firm based in Washington, D.C. A little bit of background. In the late 80s, I worked with the Catholic Health Association to develop really the first accounting framework for hospital community benefit. And that accounting framework now forms the basis for Schedule H of IRS Form 990. So I've been at the table as we've had debates back in Washington around what should be counted as community benefit, and then how, from a policy standpoint, that should all be approached. So I've been asked basically to provide a quick summary of what's happened at a federal level regarding community benefit. So on this one slide, I kind of have a history of how we got to today. We had some concerns about tax-exempt hospitals. This was in the 60s, 70s, 80s. A lot of those came because we had growth in the for-profit hospital world, and some researchers did comparisons of tax-exempt hospitals to for-profit hospitals, and those researchers didn't find too many differences between the two types of facilities. That's what led the Catholic Health Association to conclude that the part of the problem is we don't have a really good way to actually measure and account for the community benefit we provide. So I worked on that with CHA. Then Chuck Grassley back in Washington got wind of this work. The CHA had been working this for roughly 25 years, and he encouraged the IRS to create what's called Schedule H within the annual information return that tax-exempt hospitals file. And I worked with the IRS directly on designing the form and developing instructions for hospitals to follow as they prepare their responses to Schedule H. If you've ever looked at it, it's a fairly extensive component of the 990, requires documenting the community benefit spend across different buckets of activity, and also lots of questions relating to the next development, which is 501R. That was added by the Affordable Care Act as of 2010, and it creates a series of new requirements at a federal level that, to be 501c3, tax-exempt hospitals are required to meet. We had to wait about 4 years to get the final regulations that translate the language of the Affordable Care Act into the specific requirements hospitals need to follow. And I have an arrow going back to Schedule H, because the IRS then baked those final requirements into a bunch of questions that are yes, no, and provide details. This is how we're complying with what's required. In terms of those requirements, 501R requires every 3 years hospitals to do a community health needs assessment, and this applies to each unique hospital facility operated by a 501c3 hospital. Hospitals then are to develop a strategy around tackling the most significant community health needs. And then we've got some charity care requirements, and that a lot of that relates to how do we widely publicize the fact that we've got charity care at this facility. And we have to translate our policies into multiple languages, make it widely known that we've got it. And there's some specific requirements around how we price the care provided to those qualifying for charity. We can't bill more than what's called amounts generally billed to third-party payers, and that basically means that if you're low income, qualify for charity, you won't be asked to pay any more than the hospital gets for privately insured individuals. We also have a series of billing and collections requirements. The biggest one there is providing people plenty of time to apply for financial assistance. And before there's any kind of extraordinary collections action, that's like an adverse credit reporting or some kind of legal action, before there's any of that done by the billing office, the hospital has to do a lot of work to prove that the patient basically doesn't qualify for the charity care program. So a lot of things happened through the Affordable Care Act and recently through Schedule H back at a federal level. So we have this current framework for the feds, and we've got IRS staff actively assessing compliance with these requirements. So we've got people back in Washington or Utah, wherever the IRS staff are, and they're checking websites, they're reading these reports, they're making sure that hospitals are fully in compliance with these new standards. In terms of the community benefit reporting, this is a table I designed for the Catholic Health Association in the late 80s. Each of these rows here it represents a category of community benefit as defined by the Catholic Health Association and now by the IRS. And so this has had roughly 30, 35 years of scrutiny by the field as well as the federal government. So we have charity care. We do have Medicaid shortfalls. The cost of other means-tested government programs. So that means it's a government health insurance program where to qualify, you have to be low income. That's what the means test is all about. Then we have community health improvement services, and this is where the social determinants would come in. So as hospitals invest in those types of programs, the expense of that gets reported here as part of the 990. Health professions education, training interns and residents, nursing students and the like, that gets counted. And then subsidized health services, and these are the clinical programs we provide because they're really needed by the community, even though they lose money. So a key example of that is a psychiatric unit, and that's chronically under-reimbursed at a hospital level, but hospitals keep providing these services because they're needed by the community. And the researchers have found that this is a key difference between our for-profit facilities and our tax-exempt facilities. It's these types of programs in particular that are different. Certain types of research also count, not all the research done in a hospital, but the publicly funded research. And then if the hospital gives money to support community-based organizations and they restrict that money to a community benefit purpose, that's counted as well towards community benefit. This is all expressed as expense. So the bottom right-hand corner is what percent of our expense is going into these types of activities on an annual basis. And this has been the filled out by tax-exempt hospitals and organizations since 2008. Importantly, this is all filed by organization, or EIN. It's not filed by facility. So you may have some organizations that include multiple facilities, so several facilities kind of roll up into one report like this. So just quickly, all of this work, there's a definition of community benefit that flows in here, and that's behind what we count as community benefit. The first is we're responding to community health needs, and we're also seeking to achieve a certain set of objectives, including improving access to health services, and that's where charity care comes in, and that's where Medicaid services also come in. We've historically documented on a pretty good basis that Medicaid recipients don't have the same level of access as Medicare patients and others. So opening up the doors to Medicaid patients, that's been part of this framework for many, many years. And I should just go back for a second. Again, what you don't see here, you don't see Medicare being reported in its entirety. But if we do have a heavily Medicare-oriented program, we can report that as subsidized health services if we're losing money on that program and there's a community need for it. So Medicare does come in. It just doesn't come in its entirety. It comes in programmatically. Other types of objectives, enhancing public health, and that's, again, work on the social determinants would be core to that. advancing generalizable knowledge, that's where the health professions education comes in, and also the research that really has a public benefit to it. So we're publishing the results for everyone to use as opposed to developing intellectual property for Pfizer or through a clinical trial. And then we also have here relief of a government burden to improve health. So improving the health of the community is implied throughout all of this. And it's part of the basis for exemption that if the hospitals are doing this work, there's a relief to government expenditure. If the hospitals weren't doing the work, providing the charity care, providing these public health-oriented programs, the cost would somehow find its way back to a government expenditure. That's part of the theory behind why we give exemption in the first place. We don't count programs as community benefit if they're primarily marketing-oriented, or if they fail this overall test that the program is more beneficial to the organization than it is to the community. So if it's required to be a licensed hospital, we don't count that because a for-profit hospital would also have to do the same thing. So that's the key judgment here. Is it mostly about benefiting the community or is it mostly about benefiting the organization? We also have other criteria that the Catholic Health Association tends to use. One is a prudent layperson test, that if an individual off the street knew everything about a particular program, would they think it's really about the community or really about the organization? That's the prudent layperson test. There are a lot of accounting principles that are baked into the details of how we fill these forms out. I'm not going to go into all these details, of course, but the key thing here is we want these reports to be as rigorous as other reports that hospitals file for things like the Medicaid cost report or other reports that are submitted for reimbursement and are otherwise auditable and official statements of what we're doing. A number of issues got debated and sort of resolved over the years as this accounting methodology came together. Should we count bad debt expense? The answer there is absolutely not. There was one IRS official who said bad debt is toxic to community benefit, and that's a quote. So the idea that we've tried to collect a bill after 4 or 5 months and we're unsuccessful, that's somehow improved access to care, that doesn't pass the laugh test, the prudent layperson test. Medicare I've already covered. We don't count that in its entirety because, well, it's not a differentiator between the for-profit hospitals and the exempt organizations. And we do count it programmatically, but only under certain rules and requirements. In terms of a bright line test, that's like a 5% minimum spending requirement. That, of course, has been debated back in Washington. And concerns were about the unintended consequences of something like that, one of them being that certain types of hospitals might have trouble with the bright line test, like a children's hospital that typically has very little charity care because, fortunately, most kids that are low income have coverage through Medicaid. So there's not a lot of charity care in a children's hospital for that reason. Another example is if, for example, 1 year the state decides to increase Medicaid payment or we have a big prior year settlement coming in, it'll look like our Medicaid losses are very low or they actually might have a gain. So just because we've got a one-time event, that might kick us over the bright line and lead to some kind of excise tax or otherwise challenge our exempt status. So there's some issues with setting these specific floors that have been debated back in Washington. In terms of the community health needs assessment work, there probably are 30 pages of regulations that describe how this work gets carried out. It went through multiple rounds of comments. Key issues there, making sure we get plenty of input from public health officials on what the needs are in the communities. And then the IRS regs do require a lot of transparency around how the needs that are declared to be significant, how the hospitals reach judgments about that. So the goal here is lots of transparency into how we decide these are the top 5 or 7 needs in our community, and then how do we then make decisions around what we're going to tackle programmatically through our implementation strategies. We've now had 2 rounds of this. Thanks to the Affordable Care Act, there was a 2013 round of assessments and also a 2016 round. So every 3 years, every exempt hospital in Oregon and across the nation, we'll be doing these assessments and then doing things programmatic to address needs that are found. On the charity care policy side of things, the feds were most concerned about widely publicizing the fact that we've got financial assistance, not just at these hospitals, but certain members of the medical staff also are covered by the financial assistance policy, and there's a requirement to lay that out for the public to understand as well. So basically, a lot of things have happened back in Washington around federal standards for tax exemption. A lot of that is recognizing that the exemptions are valuable. They, you don't have federal income tax paid. You also can receive donations that are deductible to the donor at a federal level. And we also have the ability to issue tax-exempt financing, which is cheaper interest rates when you borrow money. So that's the accountability and the transparency really has increased back in Washington, and it's due to a number of the factors that I've already raised. So thank you.
Thank you very much. That was a very thorough view, and you did what I asked you to do, which was to lay it out quickly but thoroughly. Appreciate that. Let's go ahead to the panel, and then we'll take questions.
Good afternoon, Chair Barnhart and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. I'm Dr. George Brown, President and Chief Executive Officer of Legacy Health, and the Chair of the Hospital Association's Community Benefit Policy Work Group. On behalf of Oregon's 62 hospitals, healthcare systems, and the patients that they serve, the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems appreciates the opportunity to comment on House Bills 2115 and 2047. While we oppose both bills as written, we believe we are on the cusp of proposing a policy package through amendments that will respond to the intent of both bills. First, let me start by saying how important community benefit is to the mission of my health system, as well as those around the state. We take our responsibility to give back to the community very seriously and consider it a part of our role in creating healthy communities. The topic of community benefit has once again been under discussion for more than a year. With the changes to our healthcare system as a result of the Affordable Care Act, most Oregonians have health insurance, leading to a drop in charity care. This is a good thing. We supported the Affordable Care Act for precisely this reason. People now have access to care and coverage, and we should celebrate. But with that change, we need to have the discussion we're having today. How does community benefit change in a post-Affordable Care Act world? In 2015, hospitals made pledges to keep community benefit whole despite the drop in charity care. I am pleased to report to you today that this pledge was collectively achieved. Today we are talking about statutory changes that may go beyond our successful voluntary pledges. For the past year, Oregon hospitals have been developing a community benefit policy proposal which would reflect the new realities of our post-Affordable Care Act landscape. It will also build in flexibility to preserve our ability to continue to give back and stay financially sustainable in light of any future changes to the Affordable Care Act or the healthcare landscape, which could have a dramatic effect on charity care, one of the community benefit categories. In short, our policy proposal guidelines include a minimum threshold for community benefit spending. It also includes continuous improvement for hospitals going forward and aligns with the federal definition of community benefit. Our proposal considers the intent of both House Bills 2115 and House Bill 2047. We believe a holistic approach needs to be considered around charity care and overall community benefit. Conversely, a siloed view of how to handle hospitals and outpatient settings owned by hospitals limits the policy conversation regarding enhanced community benefit. As a health system, we are moving towards integrated care, away from sick care. We are seeing volume shift to the outpatient settings from the inpatient world. As a health system, our net patient revenues roll up to the system level and capture both inpatient and outpatient operations. Again, our proposal accounts for this. Specific to community benefit investments supporting social determinants of health, It already happens in meaningful ways from community to community. For example, this fall, four health systems in Oregon, including Legacy and others here today, provided more than $20 million in community benefit funding for Central City Concern and their Housing is Health Affordable Housing project. We are very proud to be part of this work, and we believe we have direct impact on the health of the communities that we serve. I believe there has been material provided to this committee regarding this project. In addition, Legacy Health's commitment with our partners Adventist Health, Kaiser, and Oregon Health and Science University to behavioral health through the Unity Center for Behavioral Health, and our partnerships with Providence to create the first Ebola containment unit for Oregon are examples of health systems coming together to respond to community need with significant community benefit investment. If these investments were not made, the responsibility would fall on the state and local municipalities to invest further in these efforts. Before closing, I want to emphasize how important it is to keep in mind potential federal changes to the Affordable Care Act. Repeal and replace would likely jeopardize the success we have made as a state in both access and coverage. And in turn, people would again turn to hospitals as a safety net and a commensurate increase in charity care. We stand ready to serve in that role if needed. But from a policy perspective, that safety net and associated infrastructure has to be maintained to meet the future demand. The demand for services will only increase, not decrease, if changes take effect in the Affordable Care Act. And I dare say that health care costs will likely increase. The outlook for our health care system and other health care systems remains uncertain. As a result, we strongly feel that this has to be a collaborative and thoughtful policymaking process. We look forward to continuing to work with this committee and Representative Greenleg. Our goals are the same: ensuring hospitals continue to invest in the health of our communities through a robust, measurable, transparent, and effective community benefit program. Thank you for your time and attention.
Thank you very much. Please go ahead.
Chair Barnhart and members of the committee, I'm Jen Wielander. I'm the CFO for St. Charles Health System over in Central Oregon. Thank you so much for the opportunity to testify, and you've been provided a written copy of my testimony.
But would you point that out for us? Because I was just looking for it and couldn't find it. And it's probably because I'm simply not looking in the right place. What's it called? What I'm going to ask people from now on to do is to, if we have written testimonies, to summarize their testimony for us today so that we can make sure we get everybody in who wants to testify. And I'm not seeing that, are you? Why don't you go ahead and start describing what you want to testify about while we continue looking for the record. Thank you.
Excellent. Thank you. So as Dr. Brown explained, on behalf of the association, we do oppose both bills as they're written. I do want to take some time and point out some aspects of House Bill 2047 that we believe the solution the association is bringing forward on our behalf solves the intent of that bill. House Bill 2047 calls for 40% of hospital-owned clinics to be seeing Medicaid and uninsured patients. The points that I would like to point out: hospitals and outpatient clinics cannot dictate who walks through the doors to receive care. At St. Charles, just like many other health systems across the state, we provide services to anyone who walks through our doors, regardless of their ability to pay. In addition to that, our financial assistance policies and charity care programs extend to all of our care settings, whether that's inpatient hospital, outpatient hospital, or our clinics, and they cover both uninsured and underinsured. This has been a very critical component of our charity program as care moves from an inpatient to an outpatient setting. Additionally, when a hospital or health system does acquire a clinic inside the community, it's often to preserve or save the medical services. And at St. Charles, we have seen increases in the use of our clinics by Medicare and Medicaid patients once they're acquired by the nonprofit health system. Another component of House Bill 2047 relates to looking at charity care in different care settings. As we move to a more integrated health care delivery system, our financial records are all consolidated. We operate as one entity, as Mr. Hurl explained, under one EIN. And it makes it very difficult then if there are minimum thresholds to meet in different care settings. And that's a challenge presented that would be confusing and difficult to comply with. This is why we believe we shouldn't create two standards for community benefit in different care settings. From a policy perspective, as Dr. Brown pointed out, we think it's best to look at community benefit from a holistic perspective. We are on the cusp, as it was noted, of presenting amendments to House Bill 2115 that will increase transparency and improve community benefit reporting. Those amendments will have minimum thresholds. They'll focus on continuous improvement. They will align the state definition of community benefit with the federal definition, which we think is very important, and they will provide a clear, bright line test. So with that, I thank you for your consideration.
Thank you very much. Questions for this panel? We've been given a great deal just in the last few minutes. Please.
Thank you.
Senator, I know Representative Smith-Warner.
Thank you for the, thank you, Mr. Chair. I know that we have a lot more people to hear, so I'm not actually going to go into a number of the things. I would look forward very much to talking with some of you folks about some of these issues, particularly about the difficulty in accounting for different kinds of charity care in different parts of the organization. That strikes me just on the face as being, I mean, the whole way medical systems work is you keep very careful track of exactly what happens where and what payments come where. So I was struck by that argument. I actually have a question for Mr. Hurl is my short question, and then I'll talk more with folks offline.
Great.
So just on that, because you are very familiar clearly with the charity care stuff, I was struck by the idea of the training. Some of the healthcare professional training can be charged as charity care. Some of the healthcare professional training that it sounded like there was some of that, but at the same time, nothing that, that is needed for licensure. That is that just something that internally the hospital self-report? Because I would argue I'm just trying to think of something that could be healthcare professional training that would not be for their licensure requirements.
Great question. The health professions education is allowed to be counted as community benefit, but it's only a certain type of education. The type that's in the definitions would be education needed by the individuals to practice as that in that profession in the state in question. So, for example, an intern and residents need the residency programs to then graduate from those successfully to then become a practicing physician mm-hmm. in the state. That's different than the standard in-service training that nursing staff receive their employees of the hospital on a regular basis. That is needed just as part of Medicare conditions of participation, and that would not be counted. So it's only what we do count is what it takes to train the next generation of individuals to become our practicing providers, whether they're nursing students or medical students or radiation technologists, that kind of thing.
Thank you.
That's what we count.
That makes a lot of sense. And then can I do a quick follow-up?
Sure.
Then my other question is naming rights on sports stadiums. Is that, can you count that as a community benefit?
Well, there is, I mentioned the prudent layperson test. We sometimes call that the laugh test. There's a group called the What Counts Task Force back in Washington, D.C., sponsored by the Catholic Health Association. And something like that has come before the task force, and it gets a little bit of laughter. And so we decide collectively not to count something like that.
Good to know. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Benz, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The bill calls for a certification process. Is that fairly normal? Is there a in the other across the United States, is this certification process something you would want to see, or does that add another level of of oversight, complexity, confusion. Was it good, bad? What do you think? Question to you.
I know there are a handful of states that do have quantitative thresholds for community benefit. I haven't studied whether or not they require some kind of certification of some kind. I don't have a good answer for you.
Follow-up. Yeah, please.
Right. Mm-hmm. Of course, the question is, once you have one of those follow-up arrangements, it lends itself to an awful lot of rulemaking, and pretty soon you've got the Internal Revenue Code when it comes to trying to sort these things out. But perhaps that's where we're going with this. Is that what's going to happen, that we'll have detail upon detail upon detail as people go in to try to meet these get their certification?
I don't know. I mean, it depends on how any legislation would be implemented here.
Thank you.
Thank you. I'm curious about a couple of different topics. The first one is really refers to that holistic service provision that you were describing, I think at St. Charles, if I understood you correctly, and the value of having the different kinds of service providers and different locations in the same organization. When we've been reviewing that question, one of the things that we get back from independent clinics is the response that, well, that's unfair, because the clinics owned by the hospital are tax exempt, and yet they do essentially the same things that we in private practice do, and we pay taxes on everything. What's your response to that kind of question?
So, Mr. Chair, when I think about community benefit for St. Charles, I think about it as the whole organization and trying to assess what we're doing as a group of clinics and hospitals. Mm-hmm. So when we talk holistically, that's what I'm meaning. Because we operate as one legal entity, that we set the thresholds at a entity level, so that we can appropriately meet the needs across the community and not necessarily have to have a...
I'm asking a slightly different question. Okay. What I'm trying to get at is this idea, and I'm going to paraphrase them because I don't think they would say it this way, of the private physicians groups that say basically, look, the hospital buying up clinics is crowding us out. They can operate in a big group. They don't pay taxes, so they have lower expenses than we do. This isn't fair. It's a slightly different issue than the one you're addressing. Could you address that one instead?
If I could weigh in briefly.
Yes, please.
There are other differences between the for-profit entities and the tax-exempt entities that come to bear on this. One is that the for-profit medical group you're mentioning, if there's a profit at the end of the year, that goes to the physicians who own the practice.
That's right.
If that's in a tax-exempt world, those resources go back into the organization, facilities. I mean, that's part of what it means to be a tax-exempt organization. Plus the tax-exempt hospitals, you've got a community board watching over all of this and looking at the needs of the community and making sure resources are managed in a particular way. So that's a key difference between the two. It's likely that the clinic operated by the tax-exempt hospital would be covered by the financial assistance policy, so there'd be a level of charity care offered that would not exist in the for-profit medical group. So there are some tangible differences here, you know, clinic type to clinic type. That also, you can look at how the debate has played out, for-profit hospital to tax-exempt hospital. Some of the same kinds of ideas apply.
And if I might add, Chair Bonhart, one of the reasons why the Medicaid program has been successful in this state is that hospitals and health systems have not limited access to Medicaid patients, whereas a for-profit has that ability to limit those patients' access. I would also add that because of EMTALA, those who show up at the emergency department without any ability to pay must be seen. And then the appropriate thing for those patients is to make sure that they have careful follow-up. And typically those follow-ups do happen at hospital-owned clinics. But I would also like to emphasize something that my a colleague from St. Charles said. Many times private clinics are in need of financial rescue, and they come to health systems for that rescue. And by being employed by the hospitals, it preserves those services in those communities.
Thank you very much. Yes.
Chair Barnhart, I would like to add, just to confirm, our financial assistance policies do cover all of our settings. So in the events which have been rare at St. Charles, when we have acquired a clinic, we've actually seen an increase in access for Medicare and Medicaid and uninsured patients. Additionally, with the expansion under the ACA, there's been a need for primary care, and the nonprofit systems have been stepping up to open more access for patients, which, again, because we are able to reinvest in those sorts of things each year.
Thank you. Representative Knowles?
Just a quick question, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Could one of you tell us how many of the hospitals in the state of Oregon have their own nonprofit board of directors that's based in the community versus a board that's based in part of a larger organization? For example, Legacy is based in two states. Does the hospital at Salmon Creek have its own board of directors? Does Emmanuel and Good Sam have their own board of directors? Or is there one board for all of Legacy or for Providence? You know, how does that work?
I can't speak for any other health system in that regard except Legacy. We have one Oregon-based board of directors for all of our hospitals, including the hospital in Washington State.
Okay, thank you. I want to complete the thought that I was on a few minutes ago. It sounds to me as though the natural course of things moving in the long run is that the local hospital will end up operating the entire medical system as clinics are slowly absorbed into the hospital system, following the approach that the three of you espouse. That being the case, I'd like you to talk for a little bit about the provision of complete medical services for people who live in the community. Currently, a number of hospitals which are affiliated with particular religious groups limit the health care that they provide for certain kinds of services. Could you address this apparently perfectly reasonable and normal development of a monopoly and the provision of these other health care services in a community where such a monopoly exists?
Well, first, Chair Barnhart, I would say it is not Legacy's intent to ultimately employ all physicians or all clinics within our community. In fact, we have a stated pluralistic approach to our community practitioners where the greatest extent possible, we would like them to stay independent. In fact, we have programs at significant investment on our part to help those clinics have an electronic health record, which is of significant expense. We think that is in the community's best interest and is within the best interest of Legacy. With respect to those religious directives, obviously from a Legacy standpoint, which is a secular organization, we do not have those restrictions, but we are respectful of those organizations that do.
Thank you. Anything else? Thank you very much. Representative Hernandez, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a few questions so y'all can help me understand this a little bit more. You all mentioned, and the report mentioned that every 3 years there's a community health needs assessment that's created. Is that open to the public for viewing? Is that on your website?
Yeah, I forgot about it. One of the requirements is that those be posted online, actually not just the latest one, but the last two. So you should be able to go to any hospital's website and find at least two assessments, one for 2012-13, one for 2015-16.
Does that include Schedule H?
It does not. There's not a requirement to post that on the web, but they are available publicly through websites. GuideStar is a place to find that for any tax-exempt organization.
That was a key question that I forgot. Please, go ahead.
No worries. That was one of my questions. So thank you. Do you publicly release the annual implementation plans that you create off of that three-year?
The IRS has a different strategy around this implementation strategy. You can either post it online on the website, or you can attach it to the 990 when it gets filed, which means you have to find it a different way. So again, this is how they translate the legal language into the regulation. Sometimes it gets a little murky.
Maybe I can have Legacy or the other hospital answer how they do it.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hernandez, to us, technically speaking, or I guess practically speaking, we do publish it on our website. So it's available in the same section as the community health needs assessment and give the community access to other metrics around outcomes in that same place.
Including the follow-up, including the implementation annual plans as well?
We do post our implementation plans, yes.
Just a few more questions.
Please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So on the community benefit reporting, how are shortfalls for Medicare reported? Is there like a consistent way that that happens?
Well, on Schedule H, the federal form, you do see Medicare, but it's in Part 3 of the form. Part 1 is the community benefit information. We do include some Medicare in that community benefit information. If the clinical program qualifies as a quote-unquote subsidized health service. So an example would be like a geropsychiatric program for seniors, and it's not well reimbursed, hospital still provides the program, we would be able to count that as community benefit on our Schedule H.
And is for the hospitals in Oregon, is there a consistent way that shortfall is reported?
From experience, we're looking at lots of 990s. Probably half to two-thirds of the hospitals do report some kind of subsidized health service, which means they've got some Medicare-funded clinical programs counted as community benefit. The other third either don't have any programs that qualify that way, or they haven't put numbers to it, so they're under-reporting, actually.
Thank you. Just two more, I promise. So if I show up, this is a question for the hospitals, if I show up, not an emergency, I'm uninsured, to see a doctor, what happens to me?
If you show up and to the hospital.
Primary care.
Well, I think that primary care clinics, you would, if it's an emergency, you would show up in the emergency department, and you would be seen irrespective of your ability to pay. You would be treated, and you would be given information with respect to our charity care policy, and also given information around our health care grants, so that if you were not able to pay.
I understand the emergency, but okay. What if I just want to see a primary care and I'm uninsured?
The same thing would happen. You would be making an appointment, and again, we would extend care to you and also explain our charity care policy and also the ability to have health care grants if you were not able to pay.
And I imagine that the financial assistance policy is publicly available.
It is publicly available in a number of places, both visibly in clinics as well as on our website.
And that also includes those folks that show up in primary care without
correct
insurance. Last one, Mr.
Thanks.
Chair, thank you. And this is more broader for me to understand. I'm new, so one of the things that I get to do in Ways and Means Subcommittee is learn about ending fund balance for different types of state agencies. And usually there's a certain amount of ending fund balance that certain agencies should have for their operating. What's appropriate ending fund balance, particularly for your hospitals?
I have a CFO to my left, but ending fund balance, we don't use that term in particular. So if you're asking what happens to any I think revenues in excess of expenses?
I think the question is what sort of reserves should the hospital keep as a percentage of its operating expenses? That's the question, isn't
That's
it?
That's correct, Mr. Yeah. Chair. Thank you.
So, Mr. Chair, Representative Hernandez, the way that we look at that is most health systems in the state of Oregon issue debt, tax-exempt debt, and we are rated by credit and bond agencies, Standard & Poor's and Moody's, and they specify the reserves that we should have. And that would tend to be, we state it in terms of days cash on hand, and then how much debt we have against our fund balance, which in our terms, we call it net assets. And so, in general, health systems should have at least 250 days of cash on hand for a size of health system like St. Charles, and not have debt that exceeds 30% of our net assets or fund balance equivalent. I hope that wasn't too much specificity.
No, that's fine. And where are you in terms of those numbers?
Right on the threshold of where I need to be. And right at that threshold.
For your hospital?
For St. Charles.
St. Charles. And for Legacy?
Legacy, the numbers are a bit different because Legacy is a larger organization. But, again, we're within the thresholds and the ratios as prescribed by Standard & Poor's and Moody's, who are the two organizations that rate our organization. Mm-hmm. But roughly the same.
All right. Thank you.
I assume your bond ratings are published as well.
They are.
Thank you. Representative Buehler, please.
Thank you, Chair Barnhart. Can you give me an idea of what kind of increased capital needs you've experienced to take care of the Medicaid expansion population and what you expect going forward to take care of those same people who now have coverage?
The significant expenses that we have experienced is making sure that we have adequate primary care access for those individuals. So that has been the primary driver of our clinic expansion in areas where there is high demand. And because we also feel it's important to have a lower cost alternative to the emergency department and indeed to the primary care clinics, we have expanded in urgent care, which provides another ability for those individuals to receive care. One of the challenges that Legacy has is that it's a longstanding institution and that some of the investments that we need to make in terms of our master facility plan include very expensive programs to one of the state's safety net hospitals, Legacy Emanuel, which has a level one trauma center, the state's only burn center, in fact, the only burn center between Seattle and San Francisco. Those things require substantial investments, and so over the next 5 or 6 years, we're looking at a master facility plan in excess of $700 million.
Please.
And can you explain what happens to your interest rate for financing of those facility expansions if your bond rating falls because of inadequate capital reserves?
Well, I'm sure my colleague could, again, explain in great detail, but if your bond rating in your fiscal performance deteriorate, the cost of borrowing money goes up dramatically. And so then either you have to limit the amount of money that you plan for expansion or you have to pay a higher price for those dollars.
Thank you. Thank you very much. It's been very enlightening, and we very much appreciate your testimony today.
In light
of the time, I'm going to call the next panel, Providence, Kaiser, and Project Access Now. The names are a bit small as they're printed here, so I'm going to let you state them for us.
Go quick. Representative Barnhart, members of the committee, hi. Thanks for having us this afternoon. I am Pam Maria Nason with Providence Health and Services, and I'm the regional exec for our community health division, which has responsibility for community benefit as one of the things we're doing. You should have a handout in front of you. It's just a slide deck that might help us through this a little bit. Looks like this without the writing all over it. Got that? Ah, he's handing it out now. So in the interest of time, I'm going to go through this pretty quickly and then just be really happy to answer questions for you after my esteemed colleagues have a chance to talk as well. Part of what we want to talk about today really does have everything to do with collaboration and what we're doing as a community. We are always interested in not having any unintended consequences that could slow the trajectory that I think we are uniquely having here in Oregon in terms of moving forward and working together. So we're excited to tell you about that. I do want to just point out from a Providence perspective, just to get that out of the way, from a community benefit, and what counts for community benefit, that does fall on my team. And I can assure you that Prof Park, our bridge pedal, none of those activities that are really about the good work we do in the community but have a marketing component to them that's pretty strong actually count as community benefit. I want to tell you about some of the programs that do, so that's what we're going to do. If you would go with me here, we'll go quickly. The second page in speaks to the collaboration around the state for community health needs assessments that we are doing. You can see the counties that Providence has facilities in. I think Mr. Hull did a great job talking about it from the perspective of the hospital, which is in fact what the regulatory requirements are. We always think about ourselves as being in community, as do our colleagues. But you can see the counties represented and the different entities and organizations within the counties that we have cooperatively worked with, and in some cases we have publication and research partnerships for the community health needs assessment. Happy to talk more about that if you're interested. The next page just gives you an example of a community health needs assessment for a small community on the North Coast and the kinds of data sources that go into that work, particularly around chronic conditions. So that's just a look at that. And it talks to you about public health and hospital utilization data, community listening sessions, and core community surveys. That's the kind of data that we're using in each of our locations with our collaborative partners. Now it gets really exciting. On page 5, you'll see the major areas of need around in all of our communities. Not surprising. These are the themes that were identified from Portland to Medford, from the coast over to Newburgh, and are very similar to what all of the partners that we've worked with have also identified. Those identified areas of need, you'll see access to care, behavioral health, chronic conditions, and then for the first time this year, 2016, we've seen social determinants of health and well-being actually rise to the level of being a called out identified area of need. The focus of those interventions, you can see on the right side of that chart, get a little more specific. And you could look online and see that in 2013, we did have social determinants of need, but they were kind of, they ran through all of the other areas. So I know Representative Hernandez, you were asking about that. You can go online and see what we've been able to accomplish since 2013 into 2016. We haven't cured anything, but we've gotten even better at being able to identify where those areas of need are. Quickly, give you a couple examples of the kinds of things that we do when we want to address community health needs that hadn't been identified. All of our programs, and I know I speak for my colleagues as well, as we've gotten better and better at this, we want measurable outcomes. That's what we need to report to the federal government. So the programs that we set up are in direct response to needs we've identified, and then we have to know how we can report data. So one of the things that you're seeing here is the Community Resource Desk program that we have as an example. In 2013, our needs assessment, as I said, began to talk to us more and more and identify the social determinants, as did our providers and our frontline caregivers. So part of our investment then in response to that in 2014 and 17 was to contract with one of our, in a grant situation with one of our community partners, Impact Northwest. You can see a picture of a little card on there. Those are the social determinants that Impact Northwest is able to help patients, family members, anyone who comes into the clinic. They sit right there at a desk inside those very busy clinics and are able to help address needs. I'm not going to go over it with you, but we did study this. As I said, we're outcomes driven. Excuse me. And you'll see that we have a final pilot report of the number of people that we've been able to help. Since the time of that pilot, we've now been able to expand that program. We have two desks in urban areas, a desk in a suburban area, and a desk in a rural area. So it's been kind of interesting to see the differences in those areas. You have a slide there that shows you the types of needs as we continue to identify and get better at what the needs are in the community. You'll see that we have a slide there that speaks to housing and rent, no surprise there, and health insurance as being some of our highest needs that we're identifying in the clinical settings. And I think not surprising, but really, you know, it's we've got 34% of the population who needs help with two or more of those resources. Another thing you'll see in your slide deck, then changing gears from a program where we're actually putting people from the community into the clinics, is what we call our collective impact approach to a chronic condition, in this case, healthier kids, childhood obesity. You might be surprised to hear that the life expectancy of children may be shorter than their parents due to rising rates of obesity and links to chronic disease. And we have sourced that, which means our kids could be living shorter lifespans than us due to obesity. So we are taking that on in all of the areas that we serve. We're working in partnership with community partners. There's a slide in here to tell you about how we're doing that. We're both working on that internally. And the community benefit aspect of that is how are we partnering in the community. So you can see what that looks like. And we have a range of community partners on that. That's a three-year program. I just want to kind of close out here by talking about the North Coast, a good example of where in a very small rural community, behavioral health is just at epidemic proportions. And we, for example, have partnered with the community there on creating the North Coast Crisis Respite Center. You may know that people in Seaside with mental health conditions were often put in lockup because they didn't have any facility to put people in. And so the community we helped with the needs assessment did a deep dive of strengths analysis, and the community now has a respite center there that that they are very proud of. And we were happy to help them with that. And also in the North Coast, when you look at the small community, some of the things that we're able to do as health systems is just really foundationally important in these little communities. And so we have, for example, the Restoration House. Helping Hands Reentry is one of my favorites, where they're really building now on a Helping Hands program where they're housing folks and they're building women and children's programs and they're helping people with recovery. And this is really a community-driven program that that Providence has been really fortunate to be able to partner alongside. So I'll let you look at those things because I really want my colleagues to be able to have some time too, and I'm happy
to
answer
questions. Thank you, and I appreciate that, and I would like them to have some time as well. Please.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon, Representative Barnhart and members of the committee. My name is Linda Nilsson, and I'm the executive director of Project Access Now. We are a nonprofit located in the Tri-County metropolitan area of Portland, and our mission is to improve our the health of our communities by creating access to care and services for those most in need. When we talk about the way we do our work, we talk about taking community health visions and turning them into community-wide solutions. I'm here today to tell you my organization's story in relationship to our health system partners. When we officially began our work in 2007, the uninsured rate in Oregon was almost 25%, and we had one of the worst insurance rates in the country at that time. Emergency departments were the default safety net. They were used inappropriately because there wasn't access to primary or other non-urgent emergent care. Health systems were not collaborating around the uninsured at that time, and we had a very disorganized, wasteful, and really traumatic system that at that time we referred to as charity care. We were fortunate to have health system leadership at that time who realized that while they were fierce competitors, it didn't make any sense to compete around the low-income uninsured. And as a result of that, they supported us in the implementation of a national model called Project Access, which coordinates and supports donated medical care for low-income uninsured individuals. So the most important thing that our hospital partners, health system partners did for us, in addition to giving us money to actually implement that program, was their willingness to make significant operational changes to their financial assistance policies. One thing is that all systems in the metro area at that time, which is also significant, agreed to allow Project Access Now to pre-qualify clients for 6 months of 100% donated care. I think Dr. Brown referred those to as grants for care, including a pharmacy benefit and also access to interpretive services. So health system leadership made it possible for non-hospital clinics such as the Oregon Anesthesiology Group, the Oregon Clinic, Compass Oncology, to also be able to easily donate care through this networked approach. And right now we have about 3,000 healthcare providers in the metro area that are still providing donated care to low-income uninsured people. So 9 years that we've actually been implementing this donated care model, we have served over 20,000 distinct individuals, people, and we have leveraged over $40 million of donated care just from health systems. We've also leveraged millions more care from the private clinics that I already mentioned. And even today, with the Affordable Care Act, we still facilitate donated care, and we anticipate that this year we're going to be serving about 4,500 people, which is the largest volume of uninsured folks we've served to date. So with the rollout of the Affordable Care Act and also financial support from our health system partners, we were able to implement a premium assistance program in 2015 that paid for monthly premiums for people who made just a little too much money to qualify for the Oregon Health Plan. In addition to just paying those premiums, we've also been able to lower or almost eliminate out-of-pocket expenses like copays and deductibles, which incidentally, in some cases, you can be insured and have worse access to care than an uninsured person because of your inability to meet your deductible and pay copays. And the way we're able to reduce those costs is that our health system partners automatically write off the out-of-pocket costs for premium assistance clients that come through our program. So since the implementation of the Affordable Care Act, we've paid for premium assistance for about 1,300 people. Many of them have been for multiple years. In the spring of 2014, Providence
Health... You could wrap up, please. That would be very helpful. Okay. I want to make sure...
You bet. We have a number of other programs.
The man sitting next to you gets a chance to talk, and then I'm going to have to hold over the rest of the hearing until tomorrow. Please go ahead.
We have four different programs we implement in partnership with health systems, and we want to make sure that in a time of scarcity about unintended consequences of funding health insurance for most people, while realizing that some people still don't qualify for health insurance and we still need to provide donated care, we also don't want to lose track of the progress we've made around social determinants of health. And we've come too far to go back, and our experience is that health systems have been, and we expect them to continue to be, great partners of ours in fulfilling our mission. So they've worked shoulder to shoulder with us, and we're grateful for that and look forward to meeting challenges as they come.
Great, and I assume that means that you're opposing the bills because of the issues you've raised.
I'm actually not taking a stand on the bills.
So. Thank you. Thank you very much. Yes, sir, please.
Okay. Thank you so much. I don't have prepared testimony.
Thank you.
But I just have a couple of quick points to make. My name is Dan Field with Kaiser Permanente. I'm Executive Director of Community Benefit and External Affairs. And I do have a pie chart that I'm hoping we can pull up. Take just a minute. You've heard a lot of data today and a lot of concepts, and I think it's all been very helpful. But I also thought for the committee it might be helpful just to see how this actually plays out in real time and what this looks like for one particular health system. We're a large, fully integrated health system in Portland, Salem, Lane County. And we have two hospitals and many clinics, a dental health program, a lot of dental clinics, a research center, et cetera. So if you look at this chart, this is just a reflection of our total community benefit spending for last year. The total down there at the bottom, $124 million. And then if you start at the top of the dial and go clockwise, you can see, if we pull that down just a little bit, thank you. The blue there, the major shares, are Medicaid losses and our Medicaid participation. You go to orange. And you can see that's our charity care. So the bulk of what we do in community benefit is Medicaid losses and charity care. But then it starts to get interesting. And the smaller slices are where we're really starting to diversify our portfolio and get into some of the programs that Pam and Dr. Brown and others talked about. Community health initiatives, safety net partnership, knowledge dissemination. So these are programs that are aimed at the social determinants of health that are moving away from direct care and coverage and trying to go upstream. These are things like the educational theater program, which is available free to any school in our service area. We'll go out and we talk about really fundamental health concepts in an age-appropriate way. So I won't run through all the programs that comprise the $124 million, but I wanted you to see that pie chart and encourage you, as you think about how to frame a community benefit requirement for hospitals and health systems in Oregon, I would encourage you to think about the big picture. And let's move away from just measuring direct care and coverage and towards a measurement, perhaps, as Representative Bueller mentioned, that includes the social determinants of health, which are sort of embedded, particularly in some of those smaller slices of the pie. I would suggest a good starting point is just ask health systems to report social determinant of health spending, just measure it, and then you could perhaps move beyond that at some point. Want to flip to the second and last pie chart, if we can. So what we did was we just took a subset of that $124 million, and this is just our grant spending. So the grant spending, you'll see, is just $17.5 million of the $124 million, so just a subset. And what we've done here is categorize it by health needs. So Representative Hernandez had a great series of questions about the community health needs assessment that we're all required to do, and then the implementation strategy. So what you see here on the left are the priority health needs that we've prioritized in our implementation strategy: access to healthcare, economic security, mental health and wellness, et cetera. We had to prioritize. We had to choose. We can't do everything. So there's some things up there that we haven't prioritized that you may there may be some organizations that say we really want to focus on environmental health and environmental sustainability. That's not to say that we're not concerned about that. It's to say we're trying to bring some rigor to our work and create some priorities. And so quite simply, all the grants we've made, whether it was the Central City Concern Grant that many of you are familiar with or other grant spending we've done, we've tried to arrange it by priority health need. And so what I would encourage you to do, and I think this goes to something that Representative Benz and Representative Greenlich talked about a while ago, which is let's look at the assets of the entire organization, and let's see if the entire organization is oriented around meeting the health needs of the community. And once you're doing that, then you have an organization that isn't just trying to meet specific thresholds. They're actually proving to you or proving to the community that our spending is not off on something that people don't care about but happens to technically qualify. In fact, what we've done is we've oriented ourselves towards those priority health needs, and I would argue that Providence and Legacy and others, we're all moving in this direction. I'm just showing you the Kaiser figures, but I think most organizations had a good meeting with Samaritan Health Services recently, and they're moving in this direction, and I'm sure others are as well. So I think this, what you see here, is the future of community benefit. I think Oregon can be a leader by saying we're moving away from specific metrics and you got to hit your threshold and then you're done, and actually holding our collective feet to the fire and saying, as a nonprofit health system, how have you identified those health needs? That's the needs assessment Representative Hernandez mentioned. And then more importantly, show us your strategy and how does your strategy of expenditures actually align with those community health needs?
Thank you. Colleagues, we're out of time. If there's obviously at least one burning question. Representative Buell?
Not so burning, but if you give me opportunity, I'll ask it anyway.
Well, why don't you take it offline?
Okay.
And we're going to leave very quickly because we have run out of time for today. But I am going to carry over the hearing for all three of these bills till tomorrow. And I'm hoping that Felicia, Joe, Linda, Chris, Tim, John, and Roger can come back, and anybody else who signs up for tomorrow's hearing. I apologize for not being able to get it all in today. Remember, the issue on these bills is the issue having to do with property requirements for nonprofit hospitals, nonprofit health systems, and that's what the committee's working on. Thank you very much. And with that, public hearings on House Bill 2115, House Bill 2047, House Bill 2052 are adjourned for today, and we will take them up again tomorrow with that hearing. And with that, the committee is adjourned.